We're back to the Neil Haley Show and also the Media Giant Effect. And I'm excited to welcome my co-host, Alan Porter of Strategic Wealth Strategies. Alan, how are you? And I know you're excited about our guest today.
Yes, I'm doing great today. And Tom, it's a pleasure to meet you. Can't wait to hear some of the exploits and some of the things you've done in your life.
Oh, his stories are amazing. And you know what? I guess what he's learned is he knows how to warm up an audience, but he also knows how to be the guy that entertains. Tom, how are you? And congrats. You said I had you once your book launched, but it's been very successful, hasn't it, Tom? It's
Yeah,
going well.
a cheap plug. I'll hold it up. It's still standing. You're probably going to be blurry there, but it's called Still Standing. No, and the subtitle is My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra. And it's been selling continually. In fact, I'm doing a couple more interviews after this one today. But it's been selling. It's got 405 star reviews on Amazon, and I'm really glad I did it. It took a long time. And then we'll get into the other part of the interview. But all the years, it's my 52nd year in show business as a stand-up comedian. And in all those years, whenever something exciting, funny, or poignant happened, I would go back that evening and journal. And so for years, I've been journaling all these stories, and then I finally put it into a book. And I wrote another book years ago in 2005. Tim Reed and I were America's first black and white comedy team. We started in 1969 to 1975. So we were America's first black and white comedy team. So we wrote a book called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. And I thought that would be my last book, but then I finally put this book together, and I'm real happy the way it's going here.
Oh, absolutely. It sounds like you definitely are happy with the way the book is going and the success of it. And I think when you think about Frank Sinatra, we talked about last time on the show how, you know, you opening up for him in a specific place and how to keep the crowd warmed up. As a performer, you know, your secrets, what you've learned of how to keep an audience going, do you think today's comedians understand what you understand and how to warm up a crowd? And could they be able to do what you were able to do with Frank?
Well, if you won't get the opportunity, most comedians won't get the opportunity to open for an icon like Frank Sinatra, where you have 20,000 people in the arena. Everywhere we went, the arenas, he filled up 20,000 seats in Hawaii, 40,000. It's a huge task to walk out in front of an audience that didn't come to see you. They came to see this star. And for you to get them and get them into your aura and into your stream of consciousness and your comedy is a task. And I l had some tricks that I learned along the way to get that going. The other fortunate thing, when I first started touring with Frank, I had already done about 40 appearances on The Tonight Show. I ultimately did 61 appearances on The Tonight Show, but I did over 50 on David Letterman, and I hosted Letterman. So I had some notoriety. But they still, that audience came to see Frank Sinatra, you know. The difference between the comedians today and the comedians of my era, and I'm still doing it, but we had to work clean. We had to write material that can make grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, and the kids laugh. You know, when you opened for Frank Sinatra, you couldn't say, go to hell. You know, when I opened for Sammy Davis Jr., it was the same thing, or Dean Martin. Those artists in those days, you know, I toured with Smokey Robinson. I toured with Natalie Cole, Gladys Knight, and the Pips. They had family audiences, you know, and so that's the difference today. There was no cable television in those days. When cable came along, you could swear and curse as much as you want. In my era, say in 1975, wherever you went in America, people say, "What do you do for a living?" You say, "I'm a stand-up comedian." The next question out of their mouth was, "Oh yeah, have you ever been on Johnny Carson?" And if you hadn't been on Johnny Carson in the eyes of America, you weren't a comedian. So you'd watch The Tonight Show and say, well, how can I get on that show? And you realize you had the right material, again, I repeat, that could make grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, and the kids laugh. So that was the task in those days. Today, women use language that Red Fox would run out of the room, you know. It's a whole new ball game.
Good, Alan. What question do you have for Tom?
Well, you know, it's just it's amazing that you've been on these shows, because I remember watching Johnny Carson with my father, and it's just it brings back memories, because I believe I remember seeing you on there a couple of times, and I've always seen Tim Reed on WKRP. I guess he was star there, But what you've accomplished, Tom, and doing this for years and years and years, like you said, you bring on these, you've got to entertain these people for the for like Frank, and it takes an amazing talent to do that, and I applaud you for it.
Yeah, thank you. What I learned when I went, first of all, I'll give you a scenario. The arena goes dark. Now people have been filing in the arena. The arena goes dark, and people go, "Oh!" And then the orchestra pit would go, "Bomp, bomp, bomp." People, ah, they think Frank is coming up, and then they'd introduce me. "Welcome to Comedy Cellar Show." And I'd, oh, you know, and I'd walk out on stage, and I knew that I had to get them into my aura as quick as possible. I never opened with my best material. I would first say, "How many of you people out there applaud now? I want you to applaud. How many of you people out there thought Frank Sinatra was coming out? Applaud." And people would applaud. And I'd say, "I know just how you feel. I'm a little bit disappointed myself. Now that was the joke was on me." Then I would say, "How many of you people out there are in this arena for your very first time? Applaud." And they would applaud. I noticed I didn't say, "Raise your hand." I said, "Applaud. I talk, you react." And I'd say, "Well, how many people have been in this arena for your first time? Applaud." They'd applaud. I'd say, "How many people out there are seeing Frank Sinatra live your very first time? Applaud." And they would applaud. And then I'd say, "Well, how many people out there aren't wearing any underwear," or something like that. Applaud. Now, all that was I talk, you react. I talk, you react. They're all around me. That we were in the round. And so I had to get them to get focus on the center of the stage. And once I did that, then I would do a couple of jokes about the local area. If I was in Louisville, Kentucky with Frank, or we were in New York City or Detroit or Chicago, I would do a couple of jokes about the local area that I had researched, and then I would go into my A material. But it was a trick I had to learn years ago that focus has to get to you as quick as possible.
Well, I do a lot of things the same way because when I talk to clients, I'm a financial advisor, Tom. And when I talk to clients, some of the questions I ask them, I said, you insure your house, you insure your car. Did you know you can insure your retirement? And they said, well, what do you mean? I said, let me ask this question. When you sell your business, would you rather have a tax deduction or have a tax or pay capital gains tax? They said, what do you mean? And so I get them involved with what I'm saying. And then I'll bring up other questions because you answer a question with a question with clients, and the more they become educated, the more they trust you and are willing to listen to you.
I totally agree with you. And again, I'm not a great financial advisor, but before I was in show business, I sold life insurance for Columbus Mutual in Chicago. I was living in Chicago for Columbus Mutual. I went to school there for 2 weeks learning life insurance. I never sat down with and I the first year I was a member of the Million Dollar Roundtable because I had been in the JCs, so I had a huge nest. I was very
Right.
active in civic affairs back in Harvey, Illinois, where on the south side of Chicago, where I grew up. And anyhow, so I never sat down. And when I sat down with a husband and wife and talked about life insurance, I never talked about insurance. I talked about called it optional retirement income. Are we going to insure you? Of course we are. But then I would show them a printout sheet of the money that they were going to put into our company for us to insure them, and how much they were going to get back when they retired. So it was, in other words, you're investing with us. And you're going to get a return on your money, but you're also going to insure yourself for your family. So I use that term, optional retirement income. But I would never sit down and start talking business. I would sit
Okay.
down talking to them, and I would get them. I would ask them questions that would get yes answers.
No,
So
it's just, and well, can I applaud you for being on the Million Dollar Roundtable? That's quite a bit of work. But I do the same thing with my clients. I get them involved, and the stuff that as I've told Neil, the stuff that I tell people, it's all educational. And Neil will tell you that he's never heard this stuff. It ought to be taught in high school because life insurance products are the only product that will protect you if you live too long, die too soon, or get sick. And one of the things that people, I'm 69, Tom, and I had to put my brother in a nursing home because he has dementia. I mean, excuse me, Alzheimer's. And long-term care costs between $50,000 to $200,000 a year, and it can wipe out people's retirement. And they need to know how they can possibly access long-term care tax-free. That's just one of the things.
Exactly.
The other thing, Alan, is that I told you as a member of the Million Dollar Roundtable, and the following year I quit and went in the show business. The president of the company flew into Chicago. He said, "I've never ever done this before in all the years I've been in the business. but I can't believe you're going to leave. You have set, we have vested renewals. You've got such a great foundation. You get to go into such a precarious business as show business. But the moment I went on stage one night and I got a laugh with something I had written, it was like an epiphany, like one of those B movies where the dark clouds open up and the sun bursts through, and my whole being went, "Oh yes, this is what I want to do. I want to be a comedian." And again, he kept saying to me, "Don't leave this business." But I don't regret it, you know. But there were years after that, you know, the comedy team. We went 6 years without hardly making any money at all. I had a wife and three kids, and Tim had a wife and two kids.
Right.
And we hardly made any money at all. And there were times I thought maybe I might have made a mistake. But...
yeah, but now he definitely didn't, for sure, Alan. I was looking back, you know, at the specific things, and I saw you were in Spaceballs. So you worked with Mel Brooks. Tell me a little bit about working with Mel. I got to have Mel on my show too. Mel is an amazing guy. How was that working with doing Spaceballs and working with Mel?
Oh, I love Mel Brooks before I ever met him. And you know how I got that part in the movie? I had just gone through a divorce, and I was going to work at the Improvisation in Santa Monica. They had an improvisation at one time. And I was dating a girl. It was my first date with her. And she was a little bit taller than me, and she was just striking. She was smoking hot. And I took her to a restaurant before I went to do the show. And we were sitting at the bar waiting for a table, and she was standing, and I was sitting at the bar. And Mel Brooks saw her. Mel was in the restaurant. And he walked all the way around the restaurant and walked all the way and then come towards us. And he saw, you know, looking at her, but he saw me, and I know Mel, and he said, "Hey, Dreesen, how you doing?" I said, "Hey, Mel, what's going on?" I said, "This is my girlfriend, Trish." And we talked for a few moments, and he said, "What are you doing Monday, Dreesen?" This was on a Saturday night. I said, he said, "What are you doing Monday, Dreesen?" I said, "What do you want me to do?" He said, "Well, I'm doing a movie." I said, "I'll do it." He said, "Wait, I didn't even tell you about it." I said, "I don't care. I'll be a grip. I'll sweep the floor." And to be around Mel is just a treat. A huge treat. You know, I had known his dear friend Carl Reiner years before that. Carl Reiner, you know, helped me in show business, gave me a break, you know. And it was Carl's wife, Estelle, who was a fan of mine. So that's how I got to know Carl. And he would tell great Mel Brooks stories, and I met Mel. So now, Mel said, "Well, anyhow, it's a small part in the movie." I said, "I'll do it." And it ended up being 2 days shooting, and I made some money off of it. And to this day, I get checks for 17 cents and, you know, 94 cents, you know, from the movie, because it airs all the time. And I recently emceed a Spaceballs night in the Ricardo Montalban Theater in Hollywood, and all the fans came, and they did the movie again. And
what was your role in Spaceballs? What did you play?
I had a stupid little role. I was a guard, and I was shaving, and the lead, and my mind just blanked on his name, but the lead came in, and I thought it was another guard. And I'm going, "Is that you, Lazarison?" I said, "Wait a minute, you're not Lazarison." And I'm yelling, "Guards, guards." And he had this ring that took a shaving cream can to it. He drew it, you know, to his hand. He then sprayed it in my mouth while I was yelling, "Guards, guards." And I died on the floor, you know. Now, the story about that is, that's interesting, is that that shaving, inside the shaving cream can was whipped cream. And somehow it had soured a little bit. So when he sprayed it, it must have been sitting for a long time. When he sprayed it in my mouth, I hit the floor. While the scene was still rolling, I was gagging. I was laying on the floor. I'm supposed to be dead. And finally, when Mel yelled "cut," I ran to the bathroom and it was like sour milk. And, you know, and Mel came in and said, "Dreesen, are you all right?" I said, "What was in that can, Mel?" And he went, "Ooh, geez, it was sour, you know." But Mel Brooks is just one of the funniest. I used to play poker with a friend of his named Larry Gelbart. Larry Gelbart wrote the movie Tootsie. He wrote MASH, the show MASH. And at one time, Larry Gelbart and Mel Brooks and Neil Simon and Woody Allen, and I can't think of all, they were all on a show called The Show of Shows. They were all writers, young writers. And so Larry Gelbart told me a story one time. He said how well he knew Mel. When Mel wrote the movie Producers, when he wrote the play at first, Producers, and it went on Broadway. And Larry Gelbart said they were in the lobby after intermission, and the play Producers, and all of a sudden a guy came walking out, and he went up to Mel Brooks and he said, "I don't like this play. I don't like what you're doing. You're glorifying Adolf Hitler, and I find that disgusting." He said, "You're glorifying him." He said, "I'm a World War II veteran." And Mel Brooks said, I was in World War II. I never saw you. That's what it's like being around Mal. He told stories like that. He's a wonderful man. Wonderful man.
Go ahead, Alan. What question you have for Tom?
Well, it's just I can see the passion of what you do, and I have the same passion for what I do. Some tragic things happened to my family. That's why I've become an advisor. I'm retired military. I was a Black Hawk instructor pilot back in the 90s. But when you said you've made the million-dollar round table and then you quit a year later and went to acting, you're obviously following your passion, and you'll do your passion until you die.
Well, like you, I served in. I had eight brothers and sisters. We lived in a shack. We had no bathtub, no shower, no hot water. It was a rat-infested, roach-infested shack. As a little boy, I had holes in my shoes, big round as a coffee cup. I shined shoes in taverns. I set pins in bowling alleys. I caddied in the summertime. I sold newspapers on the corner. I had a paper out. All this to help feed my brothers and sisters. I was a high school dropout at 16 years old. I was going to school with raggedy clothes and. You know how it is when you're in high school, everybody's dressing to the nines as much as they can. And so I worked in a bowling alley and I set running with a rough crowd. But at age 17, I went in the Navy and I spent 4 years in the Navy. And I served 9 months in a Marine Corps unit, an outfit called NEGDF, Naval Emergency Ground Defense Force. And anyhow, so when I came out of service, I got married and I had kids and I was wandering aimlessly doing this job and that job. I ended up being a teamster on a loading dock. I was loading trucks and later dropped my card and became management. And I was now the foreman of all these teamsters that I worked with, but still was so unfulfilled. Some nights I'd be in a bar with my buddies and I'd be looking around and say, I don't belong here, but I didn't know where I belong. And I just couldn't find that thing. There was something inside me eating me up. And I began to pray. I honestly, I started praying, saying, God, what is it I'm supposed to be doing? This can't be it. And then in the JCs, when I joined a civic group called the JCs, the Junior Chamber of Commerce in those days, and I wrote a drug, they taught you leadership training programs by working in the community, solving the problems of the community. And they taught you how to serve on a committee, how to chair a committee, those kind of things, And I wrote a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor, a concept I had. And on it, and again, I was praying, God, what am I supposed to be doing? Anyhow, I proposed it to the JCs one night that they would sanction it and run it as a JC program. And at that night, a young Black man named Tim Reed had graduated from Norfolk State College, and E.I. DuPont recruited him in Chicago. And he came up to me and said, I'd like to work with you on that project. It was his first night at the JCs. And I said, gee, I already got a guy, I had a white friend. I said, but thanks. The next day, my white friend, as fate would have it, called me. His friend named John DeBoer. He said, gee, I can't do that show or the project with you. I got a new job. I said, gee, what was that Black guy's name? Oh, yeah, Tim Reed. Tim and I started rehearsing the program. We went into the classrooms, and the moment we walked in that classroom, I knew it was a blessing because the children were Black and white. And when they, when they saw us, they immediately, we were young guys, and we got them laughing. We would get them laughing. We'd play music. Play off of one another. And the program became very, very successful in JCs throughout the country, how to teach grade school children, the elementary school children, the ills of drug abuse. In those days, they weren't teaching drug education in a high school or in a college, let alone an elementary school. So the program became very successful. And one day, a little eighth grade girl walking out of the classroom said to Tim and I, you guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team. And the thought of a Black-white comedy team intrigued us. No one had ever done that before. So we start writing what we thought was material, and we spent like 3 or 4 months just writing, and some of it was terrible. But we finally went up one night and we did it in a jazz club. There were no comedy clubs in those days, so we ended up doing it in the jazz club. And that first night that I got that laugh, I knew this was what I was supposed to do.
Oh.
And it's been like 2 years in this business.
And then you quit selling life insurance to do this. How much did you, because I don't remember you in WKRP in Cincinnati. How many episodes did you end up doing in WKRP?
I just did one. It was a real funny episode. What's funny is when Tim and I did, there were no comedy clubs. We worked all Black clubs in the North and the South, what they call the Chitlin' Circuit, Black-owned, Black-operated nightclubs, an affectionate term. And then we worked all white clubs too. We worked the Playboy Circuit and but. When there was one routine where Tim was teach me how to be Black, it was a funny routine that we used to do. But you know, when I did WKRP Cincinnati, I played a reporter from an all-black magazine, but I was the only white guy, the only white person that worked for this whole black all-black organization. Meanwhile, Tim's a black guy with an all-white organization, WKRP. So I played a reporter who came to interview him, and he thought it was a black guy coming to interview him. So he tried to black up, you know, he put on a different suit and everything and a different outfit, you know. But it was a crisscross, and it was a real good, real. It was a great to work with Tim again because we had worked together for so long. But he was now on his way, and I was on my way in separate directions, you know. So they brought us together. It's a fun episode, and again, every now and then somebody will send me a little clip from that.
Excellent. All right. Well, we appreciate it, Tom. This was such a great time. I'd love to have you back on again as a regular guest on the Neil Haley Show for the radio show for sure. And then for my YouTube channel, The Media Giant Effect. Best place people can find information on you and buy your book, because there's so many stories, but all the stories are in that book, right? You've written a lot of them, and people that have questions, because I mean, your wealth of knowledge involving entertainment is amazing. And then just taking the break, deciding to throw away something that paid well and said, you know what, I'm going to go after my dreams. And your dreams came true with the experiences you have. Not many people will ever get to live those experiences, and you've transformed people's lives in so many ways, and you still are. By your book, where can people check it out?
And I'm working all the time. I'm touring the country with a show called The Man Who Made Sinatra Laugh. It's a 90-minute show, and it's stand-up comedy, but I segue to a bar. And I tell a funny joke, and there's a bottle of Jack Daniels, which was Frank's drink of choice. And Frank starts singing to me on the screen. And now I take the audience from that little boy who heard Frank Sinatra on the jukebox while he was shining shoes when he was 10 years old, to one day carrying Frank Sinatra's coffin out of a church in Beverly Hills, California. So I take them on that journey. So I'm still doing that. You can go to TomDreesen.com. That's my website. TomDreesen, TomDreesen.com. And, you know, you can buy the book on Amazon. You can find out all that stuff. You know.
So what tours, what cities are you going to? Are you going to Dallas for?
Anyway, we're working on something in Dallas right now, hopefully. You know,
you're going to hit me up, right? If you're coming to Dallas, right? I want to come. I'm in there.
I hope that it worked. The guy talked to me, ironically, yesterday, and we're negotiating back and forth. So I may do that.
You have to tell me. We'll stay in touch. Email me. Let's see if I can help you. Give them the extra incentive of promotion. I could help out here so that we can sell this out and it's worthwhile financially for you.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Good.
So we'll definitely hook up. Okay. All right. We appreciate it, Tom. Thank you, Alan. And that was the Neil Haley Show and the Media Giant.
Thanks,
guys. Take care.